You can let people in while we're talking, but Rabbi Artson and I last year had a debate about a bar mitzvah video. And people said, oh, that was fun. So we decided again this year to have the same debate. No, to have a different debate. And we don't exactly know what it is we're going to disagree about. Instead, we decided we would each talk about parts of the Torah that make us uneasy, things that we have trouble with. What passage in the Torah gives you trouble? And when I said that to Rabbi Artson a moment ago, he said, well, there's lots to choose from. So I'm going to ask you to start off. Tell me what passage in the Torah, you heretic, I mean, Rabbi, do you have trouble with?
Okay. Thank you, pious rabbi. So I have two that I'm going to raise. The big systemic problem, it's awful that the Torah not only condones slavery, but the Torah, if you follow the law carefully, the law for a non-Jewish slave, an Eved Kanani, is that you are not permitted to liberate an Eved Kanani. So if you inherit a slave from your parents, you may never set that slave free. And that, I think, we obviously have ways we work out around these problems. I'm sure we'll talk about that too. But it would have been really nice to have been born into a world where the Torah just had one verse where it said, slavery is evil. I would have liked that very much.
I think it's true that nowhere in the ancient world was slavery ever condemned. Even in the Greek world, much later than the Torah, slavery wasn't condemned, even by slaves, by the way. Slaves also assumed that slavery was natural in the ancient world. So it would have been nice, although it would have been...
Right, it would have been impossible. And the truth is that slavery only started to get criticized morally when we started to develop the technology that made it possible to no longer require slavery. I wish that had been different too.
Right. So,
and you?
I think there are, as you said, there are a lot, there are individual things to choose from. The treatment, for example, of Esau, when Sarah wants to kick them out of the house and God says to Abraham, do whatever Sarah tells you and kick them out of the house, and Abraham does, that is not great. But I think that the most problematic ones are, of course, when God mandates the slaughter of entire peoples. And here, I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, I think that the wholesale slaughter of people is a bad thing. I want to go on record with that. But I also am aware of the fact that what I said not so long ago, every founding of a religion tradition land presupposes some kind of, what Balzac said about fortunes, every great fortune is founded on a great crime, so is every land. And if we could go back far enough, and we read about the conquest, you read about the Norman conquest, but we don't get upset for the poor Saxons. But in the Torah, you get upset about the fact that not only do you want to conquer the land, but you want to eliminate any future opposition, which was the reality of the world. Still, I wish it were not that way, and it makes me, to say the least, uncomfortable to read about God saying, yes, you should wipe out this people.
Yeah, I remember when we were on vacation in Hawaii, and there's much talk among some groups in Hawaii of the native people wanting to reclaim Hawaii for themselves. And I would have been more inclined to be sympathetic with that, except we were on a tour of one of the more ancient sites, and they explained that the first group of Polynesians who came to Hawaii were massacred by the second group of Polynesians who came to Hawaii who claimed to be the original people. Well, you weren't the original people. You were the second original people who wiped out the first original people. It kind of weakens your moral claim, right? And I think that's true for claims of land, and so yes, but here's the challenge. If we're going to look to the Torah to provide wisdom for our own time,
yes,
then we have a different standard for it, right? So we both debated Hitchens, Alav HaShalom. He, by the way, is resting in peace and now acknowledges the error of his ways. He came to me in a vision.
A dream, right, exactly.
But you know, he was very happy to consign the Torah. It's an ancient Iron Age book. You wouldn't look to it for contemporary wisdom any more than you would look to the Epic of Gilgamesh or Homer's Iliad. You'd say, great piece of ancient literature. But, you know, if you want to know how to behave, take a look at some contemporary ethics.
Right.
But if we're going to sit here and we're going to take out this book and read it as a piece of timeless wisdom, that's part of what makes these stories then differently problematic.
Yes. And therefore you have to use the Torah to criticize the Torah. That is, if it says every human being is in the image of God, then when the Torah itself doesn't treat people in the image of God, you use the Torah to criticize the Torah.
Right.
And that's what the rabbis did when they eliminated one of the problematic laws, which was the rebellious son, which some of you may not feel problematic, depending on where you are in your stage of parenting. But
there will come a day.
Right, exactly. But the Torah says that if you have a rebellious son, you take them out and stone them. See, I told you some of you would like this. And the rabbis, using the verse of the Torah, but really very tendentiously, that is, they used it with a lot of self-conscious interpretation. What they essentially said was, there are all these conditions that have to be met in order for a rebellious son to be rebellious. He has to drink this much wine. He has to be warned right before he's rebellious. And then they end up, after putting on all these conditions, by saying, the rebellious son, lo haya v'lo nivra, never was and never will be. So they basically wrote the law out of the Torah because they couldn't imagine the Torah telling a parent to stone their own child. So that, I think, is a good model for us.
Yeah, but then let me push you, if I may. You know, in San Francisco Bay Area, it is a crime to commit suicide by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. Right?
I really wonder where this is going. Go ahead.
I am,
and therefore you
I
may
am
not
a man of mystery. So, no, because it's seldom enforced, but it's on the books.
Right.
Because there are some things that you want not to be active law, but you want to establish a principle.
You shouldn't do it.
So I want to turn to you then and ask you, with that problematic verse about wiping out the Canaanites, let's assume that it's on the books like the law about not jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. It's not meant to be enforced. It's meant to teach some important lesson. If you were to look in it for it as a teaching tool, what is it we are to learn from having that in the book, even though we, as Rambam himself says, if you encounter someone and they can prove to you that they are a contemporary descendant of one of these condemnations, you're not allowed to kill them. It's a crime of murder if you actually kill them. So the law is meant to be a teaching tool. What do we learn from it?
So not only that, but if you look in the book of Joshua, even though there are battles, it's clear that they didn't wipe out the native populations, and that a lot of populations were assimilated into, and in fact, you see that already a long time later, in the time of David, famously, the husband of Bathsheba was Uriah the Hittite, which means that Hittites and others fought with Israel and were assimilated into the population and were not wiped out.
And were worshiping our God,
Uriah. And were worshiping our God. Right, or at least they seem to be. So it's not unlike what happens. In fact, the founding of America is probably a more violent and more comprehensively genocidal founding than the founding of Israel ever was. And yet, how many of us spend each day feeling terrible for the fact that previous tragedy? And by the way, about, okay, all right, one person, Sammy does, but who else feels bad every day? But also, before you feel too bad, let me just say that this summer I read Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which is all about violence in human history. and he shows a steady graph of reduction of violence in history, and all those people whom you mourn, they were all almost comprehensively more violent even than the people who wiped them out. That is, Neanderthal and early humans, the chances of your dying a violent death were 20, 30, 40%. In the Middle Ages, your chances of dying a violent death were much greater than now. And one of the reasons why we react so viscerally to beheadings is because we live in the modern world. But 500 years ago, people would have said, oh, there's another man. They would have brought their...
That was a spectator sport.
Exactly. I was going to say, they would have brought their picnic lunch. Exactly. And that would have been not something that you would say, oh my God, this is horrendous. So maybe part of what it's teaching is like the Akedah, what we're supposed to grow from. Just like God says, no, I don't accept human sacrifice. Maybe this is something that human beings are supposed to grow out of and did.
Okay, and let me just, I'll go one step further than that, I think, and say something that I think can resonate, at least in this room, even if it's unpopular in other neighborhoods of Los Angeles. Sometimes you have to fight evil by fighting.
Right.
Right? There are times where giving in to evil is itself evil, and that it is the job of righteous people to rise up against evil and to squash it. Right? So, you know, the coalition that the West is now putting together, I don't mean to be overtly political, but I wish them all success. They should stamp out that evil.
So apart from slavery, you said that there were two.
So here's the other one.
That one we've not taken care of. That one's good. We're
done
with that.
Done. Okay. So here's the one that's harder to wipe away, because it's more literary in a sense. And that is Esau, when he goes into his father Isaac, and he wants to be blessed. And the poor kid, I mean, he's in my reading of him, Esau is just a kid who is so full of life that he can't sit in the classroom. Right? And he doesn't know how to behave with decorum, because he's got too much life in him. So he's outside all the time, and he smells like the fields, and he lives with the animals. And there's something truly admirable about that. And he's got this wicked little brother, this twerp who brings home straight A's and is the teacher's pet and is goody-goody, except he's not a goody-goody, because he's always scheming, because he's this egomaniac little kid from whom we are all descended. And he comes home older brother, and he discovers that not only did the kid take advantage of his being absolutely famished one day, and so he did something reckless and gave away his birthright, but then his dying blind father, he comes home and discovers that his brother dressed up like him and stole his blessing from his father. I mean, really, your heart breaks even saying it. And he turns to his father, into my mind, the most tragic words of the entire Torah. Father, bless me too, Father. Have you only one blessing? Right? There's no answer to that. And that, to me, is the absolutely most tragic moment in the entire Torah. It breaks my heart every time I read it. And I just want to, like, give Esau a hug and adopt him.
But I mean, first of all, no way does that come close to being the most tragic moment in the Torah. Not even close. Among many other things, even if we're dealing on an individual level, I would say it's, for example, much more tragic when Moses has to die before he goes into the Promised Land, or at least Esau gets to live and he gets a blessing. It's more tragic when Adam and Eve get exiled from paradise. It's more tragic when Cain kills his brother. I mean, I got lots of more tragic.
I don't think any of those are more tragic.
Really? Fratricide? You would rather your brother steal a blessing than kill you? I don't believe that. However, having said that, it's certainly the case that the Torah is setting up an opposition there that is a painful one. You know, the Midrash, Halivni, talks about this in his autobiography. It's his autobiography. David Weiss Halivni was a survivor who was also a great scholar, and he calls his autobiography The Book and the Sword, because the Midrash says that God sends down a book and a sword, and you can only take one, and if you live by one, you can't live by the other. And Halivni, having made it through the camps and becoming a scholar, said that he chose to live by the book in a world that chose to live by the sword. Esau is someone who lives by the sword, and Jacob is someone who lives by the book. And I think that, again, you have to extract the lesson from that, which is that the Jewish people are going to be the people of Jacob, even though that sometimes requires that they use their voice, that is, the book, to best themselves over people who use the sword, because they can't fight on the same grounds.
We didn't even rehearse this.
With all deference. Right. I feel bad for him, too.
Bookish rabbi.
Yeah. I'm a child of the fields, actually.
That's how
I
think of you.
You can see me any day on the fields with a book.
I think of you that way.
Look, the biblical Jacob and Esau are not the same as the rabbinic Jacob and Esau.
True.
By the time you get to the rabbis, absolutely, they want to paint Jacob as having studied in yeshiva his whole life, and he only appears to be wicked. He's really a tzaddik, a rabbinic tzaddik. And Esau is this... he passes as a Roman, right? So he's this blood... But it turns out, if you look at the biblical character, he's nothing of the sort.
But doesn't Jacob's mother make him do it?
Yeah.
You didn't mention that.
I'm not going anywhere near that.
But it's true. You're blaming Jacob as though he's the instigator, but it's his mother who tells him to do it.
Yes, and how old was he when he did what his mother told him? Rabbi?
Are you suggesting that at our age we should no longer do what our mother said?
This is being recorded. I'm not answering that.
Look, Esau, I think, poses a different challenge for us, if I could. For me, my way of entering into this tragedy is that the Jewish people used to be a people of the earth, right? And part of the tragedy of the rabbinic period is we were exiled from our earth and our earthiness. And so we became the people of the book, not by choice, we became the people of the book because that was the only place open to us. And I think our challenge in our time, and frankly the promise that Zionism offers to us, is can we once again be a landed people? Can we be of the earth? Not just in Israel, but everywhere we live. Can we be connected to the soil? Because otherwise we're this rootless folk whose only life is in a book. And that's not a full life. Jacob pays a high price for that dichotomy. Right? And interestingly, it's Esav, when Yaakov goes back to him, he uses plotting to try to go back, but it's Esau who ultimately hugs his brother, right? So that to me is the greatest tragedy, in part because I see it in Noah as a tragic individual, but it's the tragic alienation of Jews from their own bodies and our alienation from the earth that we live on.
And that was a very powerful theme in Zionism, and the early Zionists wanted the Jews to be farmers and work the land, and early Jews did. The kibbutz movement and so on was about that. Although, again, in an industrial society, what's happening in Israel is the same thing that happens here, which is, you know, you get your vegetables at Whole Foods.
Correct. So there's no place to go, but it's interesting. You know, we have rabbinical students who are very interested in doing work on Jewish organic farming. And we actually have a couple graduates who've gone out and done that, and we've had two who have become shoftim because they
ritual
want...
Ritual slaughterers.
Right. It's not pretty. But they did that because they want to be responsible for all of the aspects of the cycle of life and to make it Jewish, not me.
Well, I'm just thinking that that's something that we've all lost in a great sense. I mean, every time when I do a wedding and I point out that the ketubah has intertwined branches and I talk about the fact that it used to be that people would, when a child was born, you would plant a tree. And then when they would get married, you would make the chuppah out of the intertwined branches of the tree. But not only do we rarely do that, but we don't expect to live in the same house most of the time when they're grown up and get married as they did earlier. we're very deracinated, that is, cut off from the land in general. That's certainly true. So maybe that's a good lesson to take from this, that when Rosh Hashanah is over, we should plant something.
Yeah, and physically, I think there is a value to us not only re-entering history, but re-entering physicality.
So we started off by what things in the Torah make us uncomfortable, and we ended with a commercial for JNF. And that seems to be not actually such a bad thing. And even if you think about it, the Torah is called Eitz Chaim, a tree of life, which is, again, a way of intellectualizing something that was originally physical. Right?
And perhaps holding it, right? In the same way that we prayed for Eretz Yisrael when it was beyond our reach, and so that when it was once again within our reach, we would remember to reach for it. Maybe thinking of the Torah as an Eitz Chaim at a time where we didn't have trees or access to it is a way of holding that space so that now that we are again capable of grounding ourselves, we can do that.
And if it's an Eitz Chaim, it grows, which means it changes, and therefore the things in it don't have to be fixed and set forever.
Correct. And then the lessons we can learn from them can shift to meet the needs of our time.
Yeah, thank you very much.